Anyway, here we go. Dear Ajahn, well, I'm listening to your wisdom. Oh, this is very nice, eh? Listening to your wisdom for me is like trying to drink from a fire hose. That's a nice one. I've heard of it before. A fire hose. Thank you. Can you? Because it means it's quenched all of the heat. All of your infernos inside have been subdued. So, I hope that's what you mean anyway. Thank you. Can you repeat why it is okay to be happy? Why not? We are conditioned to find fault or areas need improvement. I find it hard to just be happy. Thank you also for your humour. Thank you for that. So, no, it's because this is a path of happiness. Four noble truths of the Buddhism. It's all about suffering and the end of suffering. So it's not just making people stay with suffering, it's supposed to be ending suffering. Now when you end suffering, what does it look like? What does it taste like? The less suffering, the more happy you are. So obviously this is the path of greater and greater happiness. As you end suffering more and more, as you let go of craving and attachments and stuff, you get light-hearted. So that's what happens. You get enlightened, no burdens at all, totally free of heaviness, which means you can laugh very easily and you are generally much more happy. So there is a path of happiness. Ha ha ha, dear teacher, the sign, trespassers will be converted. What is that for? That was a sign which I put up about 30 years ago, just on a piece of paper. Now, when we first got Bodhinyana Monastery, there was no big wall at the front, there was just a fence, some wire fence. And people would actually go in and just steal things a couple of times on the first year we were there. And so we put on a sign there, trespassers will be prosecuted. No one paid any attention to that at all. But when I put on trespassers will be converted, no one came in. Which actually shows that people are not afraid of being prosecuted, but being converted, no, we don't want to be converted. So it became a very, very good sign. And then when I was telling that to the builders, you know, they decided to make that sign, they put it up there. It was supposed to be a joke, but they put it up there and it stayed up there. Why not? And it works, because the thing which especially Westerners, they hate most of all, is being converted. So that means keeps all the knobs. So if there is anyone, any sort of people who get, any thieves come in here, they must all be Buddhist thieves, we reckon, because they're not afraid of being converted, because they're already Buddhist. So we put that up there anyway, and somebody took a photo of it, and they were coming on a retreat, they were from UK. And in one, I think, the Daily Telegraph, they had a funniest sign of the month award, and it won the funniest sign of the month in UK. So it's up there. But that was me. I invented that one. If a blind person gets a nimitta, can't he or she experience to see the nimitta in the mind's eye because the physical eye is not functioning anyway in letting go of the body? Thanks very much. Now that depends. If it's blind since birth, they won't have a perception of sight. So it would be very difficult for them to be able to see it in terms of a light. They won't know what a light means. So you know, it'll be they'd have some other perception of it. Unless, of course, they could remember their past lives when they could see it before. So anyway, you ain't blind. So maybe we don't know. Anyway, wait and see. Dear Ajahn Brahm, Yahoo! Bliss the teddy bear is back. You've given it a name, Bliss. That's a nice name for teddy bear, Bliss. Okay. A thousand thanks. To me, this white teddy bear represents peace, love, and happiness. To me, it represents stillness and being quiet. Noble silence. If you can emulate this teddy bear and be absolutely quiet for the next, how many days we've got left, I guarantee you'll at least get nimittas. If you can be as silent as a teddy bear. Challenge? The thing is, that if you're not getting any nimittas, you can't complain. Because you can't talk. You've got to be silent like a teddy bear. Please tell us how this teddy bear get the special seat next to you. I don't know. How do you get up there, teddy bear? Ask the teddy bear. Is the four stages of enlightenment, streaming, Sotapanna, Sakadagami, Anagami, Arahatas, stream meaning once returning, non-returning Arahats, and the four stages of jhana, first, second, third, and fourth jhana, are the same? No, they're not at all. Nothing much to do with each other, only the jhanas are one of the most important ingredients to get the enlightenment. That is why there is one sutta which is so clear, which says you cannot become a non-returner or fully enlightened without getting at least one of these jhanas. No more than you can get to the heartwood of a tree without going through the bark and the sapwood. So you know, these jhanas are important. One of the reasons is because it's part of the Eightfold Path. The Buddha taught the Eightfold Path as a way to get enlightened. And jhanas are number 8 of the Eightfold Path. And the Buddha was so wise and so compassionate. If the jhanas weren't necessary, he would have given us the Sevenfold Path. But they are necessary. That is why there's an Eightfold Path with the jhanas in, and that's why I teach them. So yes, if you want to become enlightened, jhanas are part of the path. And tomorrow, if I'm still alive by tomorrow morning, and I expect to be, but you never know, that we are going to be talking about insights and what insight means and how that gets you enlightened. 2 to 3 days ago, I loudly shushed someone who was talking. I didn't see them, just heard them. I just want to apologize to them. And anyone else who heard me, I'm very sorry if I upset someone with lots of metta and forgive. They okay to go shushing someone they were talking to. So, no need to apologize or feel guilty. You know what happens in Buddhism? We don't do guilt and punishment. There is no punishment here. And you all know the story of the Anagarika who had a sandwich in the afternoon. He wanted to be punished. And you know that story? No, some of you do. I'll just quickly go through it. There was one of these Anagarika. You see them in white sitting in the back over there. They also have to keep the 8 precepts, not allowed to eat in the afternoon, nighttime, evening, or until the dawn of the next day, just like the monks. And one of these young Anagarikas came to see me early one morning. He said he hadn't slept the night before. He felt so guilty because the previous afternoon he felt hungry. And no one was looking. He went into the monastery kitchen of Bodhinyana, made himself a sandwich, and ate it. He broke the rule. And he felt so bad, he hadn't slept, he couldn't actually confess to me quick enough. And I told him, well done, because as long as you acknowledge your faults, that's all you need to do. Now I said, now eat more at lunchtime, and if you still feel hungry, eating more at lunchtime, there's all these little loopholes. You can have cheese, you can have chocolate, you can have honey, you can have orange juice. There's so much stuff you can eat. You can actually drink the whole jar of honey if you want. Have a whole big bar of chocolate. We've got heaps. So you don't need to feel hungry. Okay, you can go. And he said, that's not good enough. He said, I demand to be punished, because if you don't punish me, I'll do it again. There are some people like that. So I had to think of a punishment for this young man. And it was just a coincidence. I've been reading a book by Philip Hughes called The Fatal Shore. Is it Philip? No, not Philip. Something Hughes. Robert Hughes, yeah. The Fatal Shore. And I'd just been reading this about the early history of Australia, when they would send these convicts to Australia, and if they did anything wrong, they would get flogged with this special type of whip called the Cat of Nine Tails, known as a cat for short. And so I'd just been reading these horrendous, brutal punishments. So So I looked this guy in the eye and said, "You want a punishment? I'll give you a traditional Australian punishment. I will give you 50 strokes of the cat." And this young man, I can picture him today, all the blood draining from his face, his lower lip quivering, as I could read his mind, "That's not the type of punishment I wanted." And he didn't know much about Buddhism. He really thought I was going to whip him. And that's when you had to explain the punishment of 50 strokes of the cat in a Buddhist monastery. We had two cats then. Find one of them and stroke it. 1, 2, 3, 50 times to learn some compassion. Because once you have compassion for a little cat, then maybe you can forgive yourself, so you don't need to be punished. That's to teach him how to be kind. Because when you know compassion, all this punishment business is a waste of time. So if you made a mistake, you don't need to apologize. Forgive yourself. Be kind and don't do it again. That's all. But if you want a punishment, there's a rabbit in the disabled toilet. It must be a disabled rabbit. So you can go in there and stroke the rabbit 50 times. Whoever said shush really loudly, "I sentence you to 50 strokes of the rabbit." It's gone. Oh, where's it gone, Sir Daniel? Okay, so you can borrow it. It's over there. If that doesn't work... Okay. But anyway, you can find it. If not the 50 strokes of the rabbit, 50 strokes of the teddy bear. Anyway, a couple of days ago, I felt as if the breath caught me. I watched it without choice. Following this, strong negative thoughts arose. Weird. About 3 to 4 days ago, the breath was breathing me, instead of me breathing the breath. It was effortless and pleasant to watch. About an hour and a half passed easily. Sometimes, usually, and certainly to begin with, when the breath comes up, there is an anxiety around whether it will stay, a doubt about watching it, a craving, tension is thus generated. When the Buddha said to calm the breath, is it the feeling of anxiety, tension, craving is referring to? It's all of those things. So the breath, whatever is there which is disturbing the breath, it's also controlled as well, which makes it sort of uncalm. In the past, due to this anxiety and the unpleasantness of the tension, I've disregarded, almost rejected the breath, as if its imperfection meant I was unworthy of it. And the last part is important, that if the breath doesn't become pleasant, after a while the mind will turn away from it. It will go thinking, it will go fantasizing, it will fall asleep, because your mind is not being satisfied. The mind needs pleasure or satisfaction in the same way your tummy needs food. So if it doesn't get the happiness through meditation, it will go fantasizing, dreaming, all sorts of stuff. Which is why that when you do start watching the breath, see if you can calm it down as quickly as possible so it feels very pleasant. And by calming it down, a lot of times it's letting it be. So letting it be, letting it go, is when the breath breathes you, as you said. Not that you do the breath. It becomes natural and easy, no effort at all. You're not doing it. It's just doing itself. Even I was reading years ago about these top gymnasts who compete in things like the Olympic Games. And they said that they train, but when they compete, they forget everything they were ever taught, and they get into the zone, they used to call it, into the zone, where they just go through these incredible contortions and maneuvers and somersaults, and it's effortless. They don't decide what to do. It just, you know, the body just does it. And they said that's when they compete to a really, really high level. When it's effortless, it flows, and there's no will involved while they're actually performing. The same way people who are these great concert pianists or other great performers. There was this one monk, he disrobed, and he married this top Indian dancer, classical dancer, who goes on the the magazines, the glossy magazines in India. She was really, really famous. And when I was talking with her, she said, "That's how I dance at such a high level. I train, 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 but when I perform, I forget everything and just let the dance dance me." Now that's in those states of letting go. And if you talk to any great performer, whether it's a dancer, a ballet dancer, a musician, or an athlete of that caliber, they will say exactly the same. They get into this zone of effortlessness, and that's when they get gold medals. Was the Blessed One still alive when the second and third turning of the Dharma wheel occurred? If you mean the Buddha. No, the Buddha, he passed away at the age of 80. There's no second and third turning of the Dharma wheel. It's only turned once, and it's kept on going all this time. I know people like to say the second and the third, and because of that we can say the fourth turning of the Dharma wheel was when Jhana Grove was inaugurated. But people can say that. That's just ego and conceit. The only time the Dharma wheel was started was under the Bodhi tree. Was at Bodhgaya. Where was it? At Sarnath, in the deer park, when he taught the Dharma. That's when it started. And if you read the suttas there, he said, "Now this wheel, once it started, it cannot be stopped. Not by devas, not by brahmas, not by kings, not by anyone." It's a very powerful saying. He said, once it's going, it's going. And of course, you know, it's this same old Dharma wheel has been going. It's come all the way to Australia. How it crossed the oceans, you know, a wheel crossing the oceans. It must have come in an aircraft or in a boat or something, but it never sunk on the way. So here it is in Australia, in many other countries. But have you ever wondered why Buddhism is so strong in Australia? And especially over here on the west coast of Australia. Because, you know, some of you from Melbourne, from Sydney, there's nothing as big as this, as strong as this over in the east coast. Why Perth? Why have we got not just the great monks' monastery, a bhikkhuni monastery flourishing, and a great sort of Jhana Grove centre, and all this other stuff which we send talks all over the world? There's two reasons for that. First reason is the Buddha had a dream. His dream was that his head was on the Himalaya mountains. And he was laying on his right side. And he was looking to the west. And people thought from that dream he meant that the Dhamma would go to the west. But that is the wrong interpretation. His head may have been turned to the west, but his feet were pointing south. And it's the way your feet point is the way you go. It meant the Dhamma was going south. And how much more south can you get than Australia? That's number one. It was saying that Australia will be the place where the Dhamma will spread. And why the west coast of Australia? And it is because if you look at the well-known proven theory of tectonic plates, thousands of years ago, where you're sitting now on these hills in Western Australia, this was part of India. The Indian subcontinent and here were joined. So a few thousand years ago. That's absolutely true. Okay, there's no doubt about that. This was right next, joined to India. So the previous Buddhas, people like the Buddha Kassapa, would have probably walked over this land. Would have walked over Dhammasala Monastery. Would have walked over Bodhinyana and Jhana Grove. Because this was part of India. Wouldn't have been able to walk to Melbourne and Sydney. That's too far. And they didn't have any aircraft in those days. But Perth, yes. So now that's the answer. Why all the power is here. So was the Blessed One alive when Jhana Grove was made and Dhammasala when the bhikkhunis were ordained? That's the third turning of the Dhamma wheel. No, it was well past. And the wheel was only turned once. Dear Ajahn, your 9-day retreats are immensely popular, and applying online is like winning a lottery ticket. Yes. I am sure many people are disappointed and miss out on several retreats. Exactly. So it's not about lottery, it's whether you've got good karma or not. If you've got good karma, you can get on. If you ain't, bad luck. Since there are many Ajahns in Bodhinyana, I would like to request that more 9-day retreats be open and allowable to the public. I'm sure they are more than qualified to teach. People like Ajahn Brahmani, Sujata, Ajahnapi, etc. It would also add more variety to the retreats. Yeah, it is, but you know what it is like sometimes. If you are going to have, say, heart bypass surgery, you always want to have the professor, the best surgeon in the whole of the hospital. And that's why, yeah, in Ajahn Brahmani, Ajahn Appi, Ajahn Siddhartha, but in the end, you know, they do the retreats, but, you know, they all book up for my ones. Why me? So it'd be great if you go to the other people's retreats, but you go up there and it's, sometimes they don't fill up. So maybe we'll do retreats. We won't say which Ajahn will give the retreat. That'd be a bit more interesting. We'll just say, this 9-day retreat is being run by Ajahn Surprise. And you won't know which one it is, you just have to guess. And if you get good karma, you get on, say, my retreat. If you get bad karma, you get on... No, I better not go there. I'm not going to go there, I'm getting big trouble recording. Dear Ajahn Brahm, retreat is great. You are an excellent teacher. Food and all other facilities are superb. The anchor is fantastic, and we are very grateful to her. But one thing is missing. Why the but? You know, why having fault-finding mind? You're doing well. When people are having lunch and afternoon tea in the dining hall, it is very hot there. If there are some fans, that would be great. There's lots of my fans in the dining hall. Just a suggestion. Oh, you can't get it perfect, can you? No, because if it was perfect, then you wouldn't sort of understand suffering. On purpose, we make sure it's really boiling hot in there, so that you'll get finished as quickly as possible, and then come in here to meditate. Because otherwise, if it was really comfortable in the dining room, you'd sit there having teas and more food and getting fat and wasting time. Because it's uncomfortable, you want to come in here. So that is the trick, which I made up. So it's to get you out. It's like, I think, that people say in those fast food restaurants, they play this music, which means you don't like staying there very long. So then you get a quick turnover of people. So we're trying to get you out of the kitchen as soon as possible and the dining room so Bianca can clean up and have some rest herself. So that's why it's hot. We should actually play some music like in McDonald's to get you out quickly. Would that be a good idea? No. Well, okay. We make the chairs a bit more uncomfortable. That'd be a good idea? No? Okay. Dear Ajahn, like Ajahn mentioned in the talk this morning, the Nimitta is too bright to handle. Help! I also said you can handle it. Don't just half listen to my talks, listen to the whole thing. You can, it's alright, let it happen. Handle it. Come on, you're a big person now. Handle it. Is the path moment of the stream in an experience of Nibbana? The whole idea of these path moments is not part of Buddhism. The path is not a moment, especially for stream meaning. That's the Abhidharma, which came a long time after the Buddha. The Abhidharma was not taught by the Buddha. It's very clear. Depending on what monks say, look it up. In the first council, when the Buddha passed away and Mahakasapa convened 500 monks to recite everything they knew about Buddhism. In other words, all the suttas. And it's very clearly written, and this is in all the recensions, even in the not the Theravada ones, the Sarvastivada ones, Sutrantika ones, all these other sects, they all agree that Ananda recited the Vinaya. No, sorry. Upali recited the Vinaya. And Ananda recited the Pancha Nikaya, the five Nikayas, which everybody knows is Digha Nikaya, Majjhima Nikaya, Sanyutta Nikaya, and Gutra Nikaya, and Kudaka Nikaya. There's no mention at all of Abhidharma being recited at the first council. And that should be pretty sort of clinching argument. So the whole idea of path moment is weird. Because they have this teaching, it's in the suttas, if you enter the path to being a stream winner, then you have to become a stream winner before you die. And sometimes they say it's years since the moment of entering the path and the attainment of the fruit. It's not a moment, it can be years. And they, even in the commentaries, they say that you can be someone who holds up the end of the universe. Because you haven't got stream winning yet, and the universe wants to end, but you know it can't, because you know you've got to be a stream winner first. So you delay the ending of the eon. You may think that's a bit weird, but at least it shows that, you know, the entering the path to being a stream winner and becoming a stream winner, getting the fruit, that can be a long time, and certainly not a moment. Dear Ajahn, what does messing up with nimitta mean? I can mess up so many different ways. You know what it's like messing up with life, messing up with meditation. Messing up is basically you get involved and you mess it up. Have you ever done that before? Things are going really well and you try and get involved and it all gets messed up. I've done that lots of times. But when you just let it go and leave it alone, it usually goes on much better without you. That's why if you've got a business, it's probably going on so well without you. That's why Dhammasala Monastery, Sister Gotami, Federal Paper, is probably going on really, really well when you're absent. So sometimes we go messing things up. Leave it alone and let it happen. Just like, you know what it's like. Sometimes you've got a wound on your arm, say. So you put a plaster on it. And then after a few minutes, say, is it okay? And you sort of, there's up and up. Maybe put some ointment on. Put some ointment on. Put another plaster on. So maybe that's not the right ointment. So take it off. Take off the ointment and put some other stuff on. And they say, no, maybe a bandage is better than a band-aid. So you put a bandage on. When you keep messing it up, it's never going to heal, is it? Just put a band-aid on and leave it alone. And it heals by itself. Have you noticed just how life is like that? You leave it alone and it heals. You mess it up. And it never heals. So that's like nimittas. Leave them alone. The nimitta will stabilize by itself. Get out of the way and let it happen. One of my favorite stories is a few years ago, the doctors in Jerusalem went on strike for about 3 weeks. And they did the emergency surgery, but you know, nothing else than just real emergencies. Later on, when they checked for those hospitals in Jerusalem where the doctors had gone on strike, they found at that time, those 3 weeks, the death rate plummeted. Not so many people died when the doctors weren't messing about. Doctor. That's interesting. What's going on there? A lot of times, if we just let sort of things happen, a lot of times that's all it really needs. It just needs some peace, some quiet, some protection, and it sort of tends to balance all by itself. Good day, Brahmi, mate. I really did try the kangaroo hop, not bad. But how do you maintain in the moment a mindfulness? Ta,
you silly old kangaroo.
That's very nice. As I said, you're silly old kangaroo, it's somebody else. You have a bit of fun in the meditation retreat, that gives you some energy, and after a while, you know, you do a little kangaroo hot meditation, and afterwards you sit meditation, you're very happy, you get some nice meditation. So well done. I came across a person who was dying in the street. Hubby wasn't in this street. Is anybody here? Who's missing tonight? Whatever you do, don't call doctor after the last story of Jerusalem. What is the best way to assist someone who is dying besides calling 911, chanting, speaking, reassuring? The best way to assist them is to ask if they completed their will yet. Now, if someone who is dying, okay, you care for them. Now, there was, in the Buddhist Gem Fellowship, one of the places I go to in Malaysia, in KL, there was a Tibetan nun, and she did a very interesting workshop on dying. She split the group into two, and one had to pretend to be dying, and the other had to pretend, they paired off, the other had to pretend to be assisting them. So they were just, you know, talk to each other and just, and then one of them pretend to have a heart attack, ooh, 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 and fall on the floor. And the other one would pretend to be the doctor or the, you know, the medic or just a friend trying to help them. Just, you know, to role play. And then afterwards, they asked the people who were dying, what was it like to have this person around you? And they all started to say that it was only role playing. They thought this is what happened, and probably it did happen. You know, if ever they saw someone dying, they said it was so intrusive having this person trying to keep them alive, calling the ambulance, holding them, reassuring them, making all this noise and palaver. When they said dying should be a private moment of calm and peace, not having all these people rushing around and panicking around you, which is upsetting you. And it was such a good little workshop which brought very clearly into focus that dying should be a peaceful, private moment when you do it calmly. So they reversed the roles, and then the people pretended to die, and then this time the others were very calm and peaceful. They never panicked. They never said, hang in there, hang in there. No, focus on me, focus, don't close your eyes, focus. If you were dying, that's the last thing you want. It really upsets you. And that was such an amazing workshop. So if you are with someone who's dying, please don't panic. Don't spoil this incredible moment. Just be kind and be peaceful and be gentle. Exactly what I've been telling you to do when you meditate. Because if you panic, you're just really upsetting this person. And if you're not caring, if you're denying their dying process and getting upset at it, trying to stop it, then you're not sort of allowing them to die with peace and dignity and beauty. So it was a wonderful little exercise. Imagine you're dying. Imagine what it would be like. When all these doctors and nurses and medics are bunging this in you, bunging that in you, and telling you again to hang in there, don't go, and your wife, your husband, or whatever is saying, please don't leave me, please, I can't stand it without you, please carry on, oh, please don't die. You've got your own problems without having been burdened with this. So now you should know what to do when someone is dying. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. And that's the best thing you can do to reassure them. And then quite often, that you know, they might even get better. But if you just really sort of overreact, you're kidding them. Okay, another one. Dear Ajahn, we know what you're up to. Again. So you think. No one knows what Ajahn Brahm's really up to. I'll make a confession to you. Whenever I go overseas, you know I go overseas a lot, you all think that I go overseas to go teaching in in Malaysia, in Singapore, in Korea, in Hong Kong, go teaching in Sri Lanka. Go, it's not teaching. I'm a MI5 agent. This is my cover. When I go overseas, it's on missions. And this is my cover. And it works. People don't suspect. They think I'm just a monk and I teach. That's just. But I go on these secret missions to save the world. Do you believe me? So that's why I don't mind telling you. You don't believe me, so I've got permission to say. Is that true or is that not true? How can you know? No, I'm not a secret agent. But then if I was a secret agent, I'd say I wasn't a secret agent, wouldn't I? But no, the reason I say that was because the abbot of the monastery over in England, now he had a sister, and his sister would know, she had some secretary job, you know, with the government service in London, until she retired last year. And only when she retired, she says, told her brother, who is the abbot of Amawati Monastery, he said, no, I was working for MI5. She was an MI5 agent. And now the abbot of the monastery didn't know it at all. She had this incredible memory. She could go to Russia, they'd steal some secret documents, and she would read them. And then so they put them back again, so no one knew they were missing. Go back to London and just, you know, basically tell them all that was in there. And she was a secret agent for MI5. So you never know who. I mean, look at Venerable Gotami there. Perfect cover. She could go anywhere in the world. No one would suspect that she was licensed to kill. Are you? It's a waste of time asking, because she has to say no. Anyway, we know what you're up to. Yeah, do you? You must have seen or communicated with other beings when you meditate 6 months in your cave. Would you like to talk about those experiences, or rather not talk about them? Up to you, Ajahn. He who knows doesn't say. He who says doesn't know. Yeah, I talk to other beings all the time. I talk to the kangaroos, the cats. I talk to ATM machines. Do you talk to ATM machines? Nice ATM machine. I talk to my cement mixer. You talk to everything. But what do you mean by other beings? Dear Ajahn Brahm, yesterday you said that we came to the retreat because we are conditioned to come, not really planned. Could you please explain it further? Things like falling in love, marriage, getting separated, are they conditioned as well? If all the things in life are conditioned to happen, we cannot do anything about it. Can't, isn't it? Maybe my understanding is wrong. Can you please explain? You had no choice but to write that question. This was totally predictable and conditioned. So this thing which we call will, where does it come from? You all know Buddhism says there's no self, there's no soul in here. You know that as theory. That is just right clear in the suttas. The monks, the nuns teach that as well. So if there's no one inside of you, there's no being, there's no self, there's no soul, well, where does this choice come from? Who is making these choices for you? Any idea? If it's not coming from you, where is it coming from? It has to be from conditioning. So you say, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. What a stupid thing that is. Why is that? Because you're conditioned for me. I'm such a great brainwasher, you know, a great hypnotist. I've got people hopping meditation with a hand like this. Could you ever choose to do that? No way in the world. But you do it here. Why? Because you've been conditioned by me. And I don't blame me, because I was conditioned by Ajahn Chah. And he was conditioned by Ajahn Mun. And it all goes back to the Buddha, Gotama. So who conditioned him? And that was a previous Buddha, Kassapa. So it all goes back. We condition each other. And that is why, without the arising of a Buddha in the world to start this conditioning process, there cannot be enlightened beings. It's incredibly powerful when you understand how this will works, conditioning works. You get one enlightened being, and they infect so many others, like bird flu. This is not bird flu, this is jhana flu. You get infected by nimittas. Nimittas, like little pustules which come up on your skin when you get sort of the measles or whatever. And the jhanas, they pop up into your mind, and they burst into the jhanas. You get jhana flu, and it spreads, it's contagious. And, you know, soon you become enlightened. It's amazing when actually you understand what the will is, where it comes from. Why do I tell bad jokes? I never got that from Ajahn Chah. He told good jokes. I got bad jokes from my father. He always told bad jokes, and so it's his fault. Don't blame me. I remember him coming home one day and he said, "Oh, I just had some bad news. Bad news, his cousin had a motorbike accident and had to have his leg amputated." I thought he was serious when he was saying this. Oh, gee, that's bad news. He said, "Worse than that." Now, this was 30 years ago. They took him into hospital, and because of, now I don't know why, they amputated the wrong leg. It happens. And as soon as that's why, apparently it's true, in hospital, they put like a big mark with a pen, this one, you know, when he's going to amputate something. And so they took off, so they had to take him straight back and amputate the other leg as well. And as soon as he was recovered, he got a lawyer and sued the hospital, as you'd expect. But he lost his case. He didn't have a leg to stand on. I remember my father telling me that. So it's don't blame me. It's, you know, I've got no choice but to tell bad jokes, because my father told them to me. "Can you please give the Pali words for make peace, be kind, be gentle? It'll help me tie it in with the suttas." Great question. Nekama sankapa, awayapada sankapa, ahingsaka sankapa. The three right intentions. Number two of the Eightfold Path. That is one of the factors of the Eightfold Path which is almost ignored. It's not giving the attention which it really deserves. Number two of the Eightfold Path. We always know right thought, in other words, right view, you know, right intention, we just skip past that. Right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, mindfulness, stillness, number eight. But right intention is called sankapa, samma sankapa. Sankapa is intention. And the right intention, there's three samma sankapas: nekama sankapa, avayapada sankapa, and ahimsaka sankapa. The last one, ahimsa, you probably know from the teachings of Mahatma Gandhi. He had this big ahimsa, non-violence, gentleness. And that's number three. Avayapada is non-ill will. It is a synonym for metta, kindness. And nekama is letting go, renunciation. Making peace is not 100% accurate, but that's really what it means. You make peace, you let it be. You renounce control. Those are the three right intentions. And that's why I mention that remember where you are coming from when you're meditating. If you have got, you know, trying to attain something rather than letting go, that's not right intention. You've lost the Eightfold Path. If you've got ill will, "I'm hopeless, come on, get your act together, Ajahn Brahm. Stop falling asleep, you know, be straight, don't stop thinking of the past and the future, come on." That is ill will. You've lost the Eightfold Path. And the last one, come on, just, I'm hurting, I'm going to fight, I'm going to beat down that pain, I'm going to conquer that pain. That's not gentleness, that's violence. And I'm really surprised because people don't focus enough on that second factor of the Eightfold Path. They are violent in their meditation. They're good Buddhists outside. They're vegetarians. They give money to Greenpeace. But when it comes to meditation retreats, they hit you on the back with a stick. Or they tell you, no, you're hurting. Just watch the pain. Watch it. Don't move. Ugh. And they're so violent to their own bodies. And they're just, this retreat is very gentle. And people say, Ajahn Brahm is too soft. No, I'm following the Eightfold Path, especially second factor of the Eightfold Path. Why is it that not many people become enlightened or get jhanas? Because they're not following the Eightfold Path, especially number two. So this is sankhapa, intentions of letting go. I call it making peace. Not trying to get things, intentions of kindness. Open the door of your heart to this moment, and gentleness. So that's why on the back of some t-shirts, Anoma, you go on down there, make peace, be kind, be gentle. That's not Ajahn Brahm saying, that's the Buddha saying. Second factor of the Eightfold Path. Dear Ajahn Brahm, in this afternoon I took a nap. I dreamed about Ajahn Chah and Ajahn Brahm. You know dreams are sometimes telling the future. Is my dream meaningful? Thank you so much. And your dream is meaningful. It shows you are sleeping too much. That's his meaning. Now it's okay to have a dream of Ajahn Chah and Ajahn Brahm. What it is doing, did I tell any jokes during the dream? If you heard me tell a joke, then that was a really good dream. If sometimes we have these dreams, and they're okay because they're dreaming of good things, like monks is a good dream, nuns are a good dream. So, yeah, you took a nap, you dream about these things, because they were in your mind, I'm in your face every day. So you're bound to dream of me every now and again, and maybe Ajahn Chah, but there's good stuff. So the meaning is just you're getting inspired, so well done. Dear Ajahn Brahm, as a Westerner, talking about ghosts is a little strange to me, to put it mildly. However, I think the house I rent may have a ghost in it. Or at least sometimes be visited by a ghost. It is not a very nice ghost, to say the least. More like a Catholic mafioso type being, or Nazi. Can ghosts be dangerous to humans? The house is a small, ordinary, basic house in the bush, but close to town, and I only rent it. Why would such a ghost be attached to something ordinary? I really like the house and where I live, and would find it difficult, if not impossible, to find another place. Possibly, though, I should move. Any suggestions? I have tried sending metta, but its greed and yuckiness is too much for my metta attempts. What should I do for the ghost in your house? I like ghosts. Recently, when I was doing a funeral service, it was a burial for a Chinese person here in Perth. And if you know Karakata Cemetery, the Chinese plots at the furthest from the entrance way, you have to walk a mile before you reach the place where they get buried. And I've done this many times, so I knew it was going to be a long walk. So I was walking with the funeral director, and I started chatting to her. How long have you been working for this funeral company? She said, about 20, 30 years. She'd been a long time in that industry. I said, great. Have you got any nice ghost stories? She said, heaps of ghost stories. I said, tell me your scariest one. So, just passing the time, before we got to the gravesite. So she told me her scariest ghost story. Now, for those of you who go to funerals, especially here in Australia, you find that the coffin is put in this big vehicle called the hearse. And you might notice that it's always immaculately clean, both inside and outside. Because they have to hire someone who cleans it inside and outside before every funeral. Even if they do two or three funerals a day, it's cleaned after one has finished before the next one starts. Simply because they get a lot of money and they have to present a perfect vehicle for the casket. So this unfortunate man, had just finished cleaning the hearse, inside and out. And then he locked the door. And it's... Just look at your faces, makes me laugh. And he locked the door. And as soon as the door was locked, for no reason, no scientific reason at all, the window started to mist up inside. A condensation appeared on all the windows of the hearse. And that was weird. But even more strange, handprints started to appear on the mist, on the inside. Something inside was trying to get out. And there was nothing inside. That was freaky. So that was one story she told me about, you know, they have lots of ghost stories in these funeral parlors. So yeah, there are ghosts around. But if there's a nasty one, please remember that ghosts are lower realms. We are higher realms. So you have actually got more power, even you, than these ghosts. And I liken it to the story, I've never seen this, but people tell me that an elephant, this huge elephant, is afraid of a mouse. Now why would an elephant be afraid of a mouse? The elephant can crush the mouse so easily. Can a mouse crush an elephant? Can a mouse do any harm to an elephant, but still elephants are afraid of it? That is so similar to human beings being afraid of ghosts. You are so much more powerful. You're like an elephant compared to a mouse, a human being compared to a ghost. But just like most elephants, they're terrified of mice. Human beings are terrified of ghosts. You can blow it out again, for goodness sake. So, imagine it goes inside the trunk, come inside, it goes smashing against the tree. Or even better, they can actually suck one in each and have these wars with the other elephants, shoot each other. That'd be really good fun. You know, they could have these gunfights like High Noon, these two elephants walking together. And then they draw, and then this mice comes out of the mouth, and the other one comes out to see which one gets shot. Anyway, no. The elephant is far stronger. So, if you have a ghost like that, you tell it, get out, don't mess around. You can order it, and it has to leave. Be forceful. Sometimes, if you give it metta, the ghost takes advantage of you. It's like some of the bosses at work. So remember that in the story of the bad snake, you're allowed to hiss, especially at ghosts. Tell it what for. Get out. Or stop messing around. And the ghost has to leave. That's why, because monks know about ghosts. You know, they're terrified of monks. So they run away from monks. Because we know we've got their number. And they just can't sort of stand us. So anyway, that's what goes. Tell it to leave. And if it doesn't want to leave, stop messing around. Dear Ajahn, three short questions. What is the difference between an Ajahn and a Bante? Okay. A Bante is a word you can say to anybody. An Ajahn means a teacher. So, that is, an Ajahn means a teacher, a Bante means any monk or... And we say the Ajahn for the nuns as well, senior nuns are Ajahns, and instead of Bantes, we call them Ayahs. I don't really like that word, because that means they're higher than the monks. which is not really fair. Okay. But you've got to be careful, because there was one nun some time ago, and she was really, really, like Margaret Thatcher in brown robes. And she got the nickname. All the monks and the people who knew her used to call her the Ayatollah. That's what she was called that. So Aya. So be careful, so Ayatollah. And sometimes we wondered, should we call the head nun in the monastery the abbess? Because, they call me an abbot. But there was one nun who was an abbot of a monastery, and they never called her the abbess, they called her the abyss. And she sort of deserved it. So be really careful. That's why we call, the head nun is also called an abbot as well, instead of the abyss. And be careful with ayah, because it would be the Ayatollah. Anyway, next question. Is it possible to stay at Jhana Grove when there is no retreat? If you behave, you can. How could one become an Anagarika? You shave off your hair, wear white, and hopefully you can get into a monastery. If three questions are too much, you can choose one. It's a bit late to say that at the very end. Why did you put that at the beginning? When we die, we can see nimitta. Is it possible to get jhana after we die? Now, that is a good question. Can you get jhana after you die? Now, there's all these near-death experiences, and recently people getting excited about this. I think there's an Indian lady who got a near-death experience, wrote a book about it, and did a YouTube video about it. And she described going into the light. And when she went into that light, it was like perfect bliss. She felt one with everything. There was nothing missing at all. Well, that's like a typical jhana experience. Now, instead of ecstasy, better than sex, the bliss from pure love is exactly the same thing, just described from a different angle, that's all. So, that's almost like a jhana experience. And she came out again and got reborn again. Not got reborn, came alive again. So yes, it does seem you can do that. Dear Ajahn, do the devas in the pure abodes interact with one another, or are they existing in some personal meditative realm? Do they teach lesser devas? The pure abodes are where the non-returners live. And yeah, they do. They came and just told the Buddha, well done, because one of them in particular, Gatikara, there was the story, the Gatikara Sutta. It's one of the most interesting sutras in the Majjhima Nikaya. Gatikara was a potter, that's what the name means, in the time of Kassapa the Buddha. And he was a devoted disciple of the Buddha. He was a non-returner, an anagami. The only reason why he never ordained, because he had two parents who were both blind. He had to support them. No one else could support them. And that's the only reason why he didn't ordain. But he had a friend called Jyotipana, who was his best friend. And he always wanted to take him to see the Buddha. You know that sometimes, you have a good friend. Say, come and see Ajahn Brahm, come and see the nuns, come to the temple. But they won't come. They think, those monks, they're lazy. They should get a proper job instead of being fed by you guys all the time. They're hopeless. They're like a parasite on society. They don't give anything. Those sorts of words. So this is what Jyotipana would say about the Buddha Kassapa. And no matter what Gatikara did, he couldn't get him to come and see the Buddha Kassapa. Until one day he tricked him, he dragged him by the hair. That was just going to extremes. You're doing this to me? This Kassapa must be something. So he went to see Kassapa for the first time. And when he saw the Kassapa the Buddha for the first time, Jyotipana was so impressed. He realized his mistakes and he became a monk with Kassapa the Buddha. And when the Buddha told that story, he said, that was me in my previous life. I was Jyotipana, the Brahmin. And I actually said bad words to Kassapa the Buddha. That was me in my past life. And you see, in the Devaputta Sangyutta, Gatikara, from the pure abodes, came down to see the Buddha and said, well done, You know, we were mates in the village, the same village in the previous life, under Kassapa the Buddha. And now you become a Buddha. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. He came to congratulate his best mate on becoming a Buddha. So yeah, they can come down and say hello every now and again. But a lot of times they would just be blissing out. Dear Ajahn, can you elaborate on karma, please? No. Am I allowed to say, no, people keep telling me, Ajahn Brahm, stop saying yes and accepting all these invitations. You must learn how to say no. So I said, no, is that okay? Anyone offended? Okay. But, can you elaborate on karma, please? Karma, there's two parts to karma. Karma is the ingredients of the present moment built up from your past. Your health, your wisdom, all your abilities, you made them up from the past. It's the ingredients which you have to work with now. That's not important. What is really important is what you're doing with what you've got. That is important. It's the karma of the present is the only thing which you should really be worried about, concerned about, put attention on. Because what happened to you in the past? Oh, you know, I must have done some terrible, terrible karma to have been reborn in England. I had a hard time finding any Buddhism. Why did I get reborn in that cold country? Was that bad karma? Did I do bad karma by being born in London? I should have been born in a Buddhist country. So I must have done something wrong. So, but it doesn't matter what you... Is it bad karma to be born as a woman? Am I stirring you up now? Is it bad karma to be born as a gay? Is it? Is it bad karma to be born, say, you know, with not that intelligent? So you can't go to university? Is that bad karma? It's what you do with what you've got is the most important. It doesn't matter that much. Because you see that people who are... my favorite story, this monk who couldn't finish grade one in Thailand. It's a very famous story. This village boy put into the primary school, grade one. After 1 year, the teacher could not pass him to go into grade two. And then maybe he was not good at crayons. Also, I don't know. Now, what can you fail in grade one? I don't know. But he failed it. And he had to repeat grade one. All his friends went to grade two. He went back to grade one. The second year, he failed again. And so for the third year, he did grade one. Repeated it, you know, three times. And at the end of that third year, the teacher, with all the best will in the world, could not pass him. He was just so dull intellectually that they kicked him out of school. And his parents did not know what to do with him. What would you do with someone who's so stupid you can't even and graduate from grade one after 3 years? And there's only one solution. You know what the story. Send him to the monastery, ordain him as a novice. So they put a brown robe on the kid. And the abbot, you know, abbots in the monasteries are always really, you know, kind and patient. He was so patient with this kid, trying to teach it some chanting. Okay, Namo Tassa. So, it's after me. Namo. Na. What? Namo. Alright, Namo. Tassa. Ta. What was the first word again? And he couldn't even do Namo Tassa. And this abbot kept looking after him, trying to teach him something about a couple of years. And eventually he gave up too. This guy was just so intellectually, you know, might say, challenged. So what do you do? The last resort was send him to the forest monastery. Well, you don't have to do much chanting. And this abbot of the forest monastery teacher just taught him basic meditation. Just watch the breath. Just let go. And he could do that so easily. He had incredible meditations. He became an arahant, fully enlightened, and he became a great teacher. Because, you know, he didn't have much, but what he had, he really knew how to make use of it. And apparently, because all monks have to do some chanting, when he did any chanting, apparently the story was that he would recall his previous life when he had learnt the chanting, connect with that so he could chant in this life, because this life he couldn't learn anything. I love that story, because if someone that dumb can get enlightened, there's hope for you. So this is what karma is. It's what you make with what you've got. And I've been teaching now all the last few days. It doesn't matter what you're experiencing in the meditation. You may be restless, sloth and pauper, dull, beautiful nimitta, dirty nimitta. It doesn't matter what it is. What are you doing with it? That's the karma of the present. And the best karma, because karma is all about intention, the best karma is to make peace, be kind, be gentle. And you can do that with everything you're experiencing on this retreat. There's not one moment when you can't meditate. If you understand that meditation is nothing to do with what you're experiencing, but everything to do with how you're experiencing it. No matter what's happening, you can always make peace. You can always be kind. You can always be gentle. You can always practice right intention. You can always make good meditation karma. And then it's only a matter of time before these brilliant meditations, enlightenment happen. Because you are making the causes. That is the law of karma. Dear Ajahn, if there's no free will, no choice, I wish whoever made the choice for me to come to this retreat will pay for my trip. Ha ha ha. Seriously, it's probably your wife. It's probably, or your husband, whoever you do. They probably pay for this trip to get rid of you. I wonder what they're doing when you're over here. Seriously, is life destined then? Karma, cause and effect, can also be destined. Not destined, because destined would mean that you could actually work it all out. What was going to happen? No one knows what's going to happen next. So that means that life is interesting. But realizing that this thing we call will is not coming from you. Will is. You can see it happening. You can see choice. But who's making the choice now? That's the question. Dear Ajahn Brahm, can you explain the link, if any, between yoga and meditation? Does one help the other? Yoga is like a word which means just what you get, what you devote yourself to. For example, you know, they say a person who does a lot of meditation is anuyoga, to meditation. So yoga is just this word which means a practice which you do very diligently. And you know the different types of yoga in the Hindu tradition. And the Hatha yoga is the one where you do all your stretching exercises and stuff. And that is what most people call yoga these days. You know, it's just one of many types of yogas. So the yoga and the meditation, does one help the other? Of course it does. Sometimes it's good to do some yoga to stretch the muscles, so that you can sit comfortably. So if you want to do some yoga on this retreat, you are most welcome to do the yoga. Sometimes there's somebody who volunteers. I'm sure there's a few people who can teach yoga. If anyone needs some stretching exercises because you're getting a bit stiff, you know, they can actually do some yoga, you know, somewhere in the compound sometime during the day, which means you can actually stretch. It also means you have a lot of body awareness. And when I was doing yoga, I was taught, don't push too much, because sometimes with too much willpower, you can really do damage to your body. So you have to be very aware of your body and not have too strong willpower. Because that willpower says, oh, I can do this pose, I can stretch myself further, I can bend a bit more. And you end up injuring yourself just because, I don't know, many people these days have got incredible strong willpower. They can endure pain, they go past pain and just push themselves, and it does damage to you. Pain is there to show you this is a danger happening, so you know, don't think you're bigger and better than the pain. So yeah, yoga does give a lot of mindfulness as well, a lot of awareness of the body. So of course, it's like anything else, it's how it's done. So yeah, you can do some stretching exercises as possible, like even the kangaroo hop, that's like kangaroo yoga pose. And it's very, very good yoga pose. I'm sure, hopefully, that the yoga practitioners have also included that in their repertoire. South Africa, because otherwise it just gets so Indian and so culturally narrow and dry. So whenever we do any of these things, we should always adapt, you know, to the new ways of doing things. So that's why if you don't like the kangaroo hop meditation, if I was in the United States, you know, teaching walking meditation, I would teach, you know, the what was it called the other day? We called it the Michael Jackson, the moonwalking. So you don't hold your hands like this, you hold them like whatever it is. So why not? Because that is being mindful, that is being aware, putting some energy into what you're doing, and it works. So yes, you can do yoga if you wish, and it can support. So that was the last question. So thank you all for listening tonight. Now there's a time for doing the yoga called the corpse pose. That always was my favorite posture in doing yoga. So you can try yoga in the bed, do the corpse pose, and have a lovely night's sleep. Sadhu. 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 Do it different. Okay.